Hello, everybody. This is Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for president in 2020. And these Green Socialist podcasts are about continuing to advance the program we ran on and get more discussion and reflection about what that involves. So today we're getting a lot of news, and we got it yesterday about this new COVID variant coming out of Southern Africa. They named Omicron. And it's very concerning because it looks like its transmission is very rapid, more rapid than even Delta. And it's got 50 mutations, including 30 mutations on the spike protein, which means the existing vaccines may be weak against it. We don't know for sure. But, the world freaked out yesterday. Stock markets crashed, or at least went down. A number of countries have instituted travel restrictions, which everybody knows at best will just slow down the transmission. If this variant, continues, it's going to get here. And we know it evolved because of vaccine apartheid. And this was imposed by rich countries to protect big pharma's patents and profits. And actually, the U.S. wasn't the worst in this regard. At least Biden said he'd like to see the patents wavered so we could get the vaccines around the world. And it was Germany, actually, Merkel and Boris Johnson in Britain that stood up for big pharma. So they're making billions of dollars on this thing. And the poor countries can't afford to get the vaccines. So the COVID mutates these new variants among the unvaccinated. So this is very concerning. And on top of that, in this country, we've got this anti-vaccine movement funded and led by right-wing authoritarians. And authoritarianism thrives on irrationalism. And then we got some nominally left-wing suckers who buy into this propaganda, the anti-vaccine misinformation. So only 60% of U.S. people are fully vaccinated. So we may have mutations going on in our own country. 60% of, or 40% of over 300 million people is over 100 million people, over 120 million people. And so that gives the virus plenty of room to mutate. So infections are already rising again. After the Delta wave, it's starting to rise again. People are on holidays, traveling. And this is even before Omicron gets here. So we got a serious problem. And, it's time to just get rid of the patents and get this vaccine around the world, or the vaccines, and make sure everybody has access to it. Or this COVID is going to become endemic, and we're going to be with this for a very long time. So speaking of Germany, just announced that they call it the Stoplight Coalition. The Social Democrats, the Reds, the Liberal Democrats, the Yellows, and the Greens, the Green and the Stoplight, have formed a coalition. And it looks like the German Greens are going to get four ministries in the new government: foreign affairs, agriculture, environment, and sort of a super ministry concerning economy, energy, and climate. And they have some ambitious goals. They want to eliminate the use of coal by 2030 in Germany. They already got rid of nukes, and they did transition over somewhat to coal to keep the power up while the nukes went down. And that was a problem. But now they have an ambitious schedule to phase out, not just phase down, like they said at the COP26, coal. They say they're going to prioritize rail over roads and transportation, but didn't put a firm deadline on electric vehicles replacing internal combustion engines, which the Greens are disappointed in, because a lot of car companies, a number of states in this country, have set 2035 as a deadline after which you can't sell internal combustion engines. So they fell short there. They do have a plan to heat all new home heating systems have to be at least 65% renewable by 2025. It's only 4 years. But that's still a compromise. When they say 65% renewable, I guess that means home heat pumps with some kind of fossil fuel backup. Otherwise, you could do it 100% renewable. And this is just new systems. It's not replacing existing systems. The agriculture ministry is interesting because it will be headed up by Sim Özdemir, who is a Muslim of Turkish descent. And he'll be the first Muslim and immigrant to head a cabinet ministry in Germany. And that exemplifies what the German Greens and really European Greens have been really good about compared to the other parties in Europe in their anti-racist and anti-xenophobic and pro-immigrant commitments. So, you know, the Germans are going faster and further than we are on climate, and we can use that to push the U.S. But I think really the German example we should be pushing is proportional representation, because that's why Greens are in the government. They got 15% of the vote, and they got four major ministries. When we run, we often get a higher percentage than 15%, but we don't get any representation. We're excluded by the single-member district winner-take-all system. So we need to push proportional representation like they have in Germany and most other advanced democracies around the world. And then the democracy question, I mean, voting rights and election protection bills seem to be going nowhere in Congress. The Republicans are out there gerrymandering a House majority for 2022. Not that the Democrats are innocent in states like Illinois and New York that they control. They're gerrymandering those states. But the net balance is going to give the Republicans power back, which is a disaster for climate, systemic racism, and growing economic inequality. Not that the Democrats are solving those problems, but the Republicans seem hell-bent on making them worse. Now, the Democrats could change this filibuster rule with 50 votes in the Senate plus Vice President Harris. But the leadership, you know, the Schumers, the Bidens, even the House Democrats are not really putting much pressure on the holdouts keeping the filibuster in place in the Democratic Party. Manchin, Sinema, Feinstein, and others who are more low profile, but really don't want to get rid of the filibuster. So it looks like they're just going to let the Republicans take the power. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, why are they doing that? Well, I think most of these Democrats figure they got safe states. In a single member district winner take all system, most seats are safe because one party or the other has the majority. So they're really not concerned with voting rights and democracy. And that's why I've been saying the Greens need to take the lead on these pro-democracy reforms, fair ballot access, ranked choice voting for executive offices, and proportional ranked choice voting for legislative bodies. And that last one is key. When we have Greens in state legislatures and the House of Representatives, it's going to change the politics of this country radically. And last thing I'll say is that I think I've mentioned this on these podcasts. There's a Harvard Policy and Law Review article that's now online. And it's about national ranked choice popular vote for president, and that we can do it by legislation without a constitutional amendment, which makes it a lot easier to do. The article is called Toward a More Perfect Union, Integrating Ranked Choice Voting with the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact by Rob Ritchie and four other people who are lawyers. And the article has a draft bill for Congress called Ranked Choice Voting and Presidential Elections Act. And the link is going to go in the chat. I urge you to read that. It's a pretty long article, but it's very interesting. Basically argue that the Constitution gives Congress the power to regulate elections, including presidential elections, including replacing the Electoral College with the ranked choice vote. And there's a way they do it. And you can read about it in that article. So I urge people to take a look at that. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions and comments. Amy Osex asks, Howie, I know you've got a full plate, but at your leisure, David Gerard, COUK, not sure what CO means, has written about Creative Commons members angry with their leadership for promoting NFTs and crypto. Worth a look. Yeah, I I will try to find that. NFTs are what? Crypto, you know, cryptocurrency, I think, is a problem. It's not a public money. It's a thing that's off the screen. It's where a lot of criminals, you know, do their transactions. And it's a way for rich people to avoid taxes. So I am concerned about that. NFTs, what I'm trying to think what that stands for. But I will take a look. Could you put that back up? I didn't get the guy's name, so I can look that up, him up. David Gerard. Non-fungible token is what NFT stands for. Okay, I think it's like a theater ticket or a ball game ticket. You can't transfer it, or you can't use it as money. I think that's what that means. But I will take a look at what David Gerard has to say. Scout Trooper 164, Howie, during your time in the U.S. Marine Corps, did you make any friends and have anyone that agreed with your ideals? Yeah, it's interesting you should ask that. When we went into boot camp, they said we could bring one book to read. And I brought Alfred McCoy's The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, which I thought would probably get me in trouble because it basically talks how the U.S. was using the and its allies in Southeast Asia were using the heroin trade to fund some of their activities. And the CIA was very involved. Well, there were two other guys in my training platoon that also brought that book. And I happen now to be reading the author's latest book. And it's about, what's the title? It's about global rule, and it goes back to the plague, the Black Death in the 1300s, and how world systems and empires evolved, and then projects into the next coming period where looks like China's going to be the global hegemon, but climate change is going to undermine that, and we're going to go into a period as bad as the Black Plague unless we do something about climate change. So when I went in, it was toward the end of the Vietnam War, and a lot of us were draft motivated. Our draft number came up, so we enlisted in this officer program for the Marine Corps, which you could participate in while staying in college. And that's what I intended to do, although I didn't have the money to stay in college. It's a long story, but anyway. So I haven't stayed in touch with any of those people, but I am in touch with former Marines here in the Syracuse area. And I have a number of them who are friends. Not all of them agree with my ideals, but some do. I think the one thing, you know, we're across the spectrum on most political things, but almost all of them think that we get too involved in foreign conflicts and, you know, should keep our powder dry and worry about defending the United States, not getting intervening in civil wars. Military intervention doesn't lead to good results if you're trying to promote peace and democracy in most cases. Eric Gray, how can we convince more people, particularly on the right, that proportional representation is in their best interest? Well, the libertarians would benefit like we would because they would probably get seats. Proportional representation would create a multi-party system. And we would have probably four or five parties like most Western countries do. And the Republicans in districts that are majority Democrat would get some representation. Now they get nothing. So I think everybody gets their fair share of representation based on their support. And where the right can't monopolize like they're trying to do with gerrymandering, in those districts, they'd be interested in proportional representation. So I think we can at least get some people on the conservative side of things to get behind proportional representation if they want representation at all in those Democratic majority districts. Emil Sachs, with Dems pressing down ever harder on the necks of Green Party candidates, will Moore do what Savage did in Maine and officially run independent? Is that an effective or useful loophole for us? Well, Savage ran independent, Lisa Savage, because the petition requirement in Maine for to get on as a Green was too difficult. It was a lot easier to get on as an independent. And there's actually a court case. It's in the current issue, just came out. The December issue of Ballot Access News discusses it. And what we required was 2,000 signatures from party members who are registered in a party. Now, if you're a Democrat or Republican, it's not that hard to find people who can sign a petition. If you're a Green, Greens are much further and farther between. So it's hard to find Greens, but the number you had to get was the same. So the judge said that was unfair to the Green Party. So I forget the standard they changed it to, but now people like Lisa will be able to run as a Green. And she ran as an independent because of the petition, not because Greens were, getting attacked by the Democrats. The fact is, we elected a Green to the city council in Portland, Maine. I think in Littleton, Maine, or Lewiston, Maine. And, some other smaller offices. So, being a Green, even though the Democrats attacked us, if we're an independent and we got a strong campaign, they're going to attack us. We could call ourselves the Purples. They'd attack, if we were running on the same platform, because they're worried. Our platform's more popular than theirs, according to public opinion polls. Howie, what are your thoughts of Tulsi Gabbard flocking to the Republican Party? Well, my first thought is, what took her so long? A lot of people fell for her BS. She was anti-intervention, but pro-war on terror. When she was running for president, that was still on her congressional website. And enough people pointed it out that she took down her congressional website. But she was always toadying up to authoritarians who were not Muslim, like Modi in India, Sisi in Egypt, Assad in Syria. And then her social politics were very conservative. One of the last things she did on her way out of Congress was introduce a bill to bar transgender people from participating in school sports. So, and now her big kick is every time somebody criticizes racist practices or ideas, she said they're playing the race card and dividing us. So she was bad news to begin with, and it's just so disappointing that so many people, fell for her during the Democratic primary, as if she was the big progressive, the new Bernie Sanders. She wasn't anything like that. So I'm not surprised she's over at Fox News and probably getting ready to, I don't know if she's going to run as a Republican. I think maybe she's looking for a job as a Fox News commentator if she doesn't already have it. Howie, what are your thoughts on the new COVID variant that has been introduced in South Africa, leading to the world going back to a similar state in 2020? Yeah, that's what I opened up with, and I don't want to repeat everything I said, but basically I criticized particularly Germany and the UK for backing up Big Pharma, preventing the patents from being waived so we could cheaply get the vaccine around the world. So this new COVID variant, and the public health officials warned us about this, developed in an area of the world where not many people are vaccinated. And so what we got to do is get those patents lifted, get the vaccine around the world. And now we're in a situation where they may have to modify or come up with a new vaccine, because this new variant has 50 mutations, including 30 on the spike protein, which is what the virus uses to get into host cells. It's very concerning. And the transmission so far is far more rapid than Delta and the original COVID. So this is very concerning. So I think, our response to this should not be travel bans, because That's not going to stop the virus. At best, it's going to slow it down a little bit. We really got to get vaccines and treatments around the world and not make it based on, pay or die, which is what privatized health does. So those are my thoughts. And I'm really worried about this variant because it doesn't look good. Patricia Fichter, why don't you and Richard Wolf team up? You're both super smart. We need you guys. Well, I have worked with Richard going back to the mid-1980s. He ran as a Green for mayor of New Haven, Connecticut. I think the year was 87. He got about 10% of the vote. They ran a slate of 14 candidates, most of them for, what they call aldermen, city council, basically, in New Haven. And we've teamed up. He's more an academic than an activist. He was going to have me on a podcast before the election, and then his producer chickened out, I guess is the best way to say it. They were worried about the nonprofit status of their podcast or the organization that was putting it on because I was a partisan candidate, which is an excuse I got a lot. So I don't know how responsible Richard was for that, but I'm happy to work with Richard. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts on Joe Biden tapping petroleum reserves? He auctioned off 80 million acres for oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. That's an area the size of New Mexico. He did that 2 days after the end of the Glasgow COP26 climate summit. He's in a contradiction. He wants to get to 50% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030. And at the same time, he's not only getting petroleum out of our reserves for, consumers, he's encouraging OPEC to up its production. By now we should be having electric vehicles and clean energy to power them. And, starting from where we're at, I mentioned 2035 earlier, Biden has refused to set a date, even though Massachusetts, California, I think New York now, GM and some other auto companies have said by 2035, we won't be selling internal combustion engines. You're going to have to go electric. So I think Biden really doesn't care about the climate. I mean, he's opening up drilling in public lands. He's done this auction off the Gulf of Mexico. Build Back Better has fossil subsidies. They have what they call low carbon energy, like natural gas for buses, school buses. And then the infrastructure bill has $25 billion in new subsidies for fossil fuels on top of the $20 billion we give every year. So my thoughts on Joe Biden is like, F you. You're just not dealing with climate, and it's an existential crisis. And you're just looking at immediate politics. This is aimed at saying you're going to do something about petroleum. I mean, about inflation. When I think the correct analysis of inflation is there's supply side problems because people are buying goods instead of services because of the COVID lockdowns. And because the economy locked down, the production of goods is behind, the shipping is clogged up. And so higher demand raises prices. That's the problem with inflation. And actually, when he did this, oil prices have been going down the last couple of weeks. So he's like late to the party, and it's not going to make that much difference. Eric Gray, in Florida, where there are parents that think as teachers we are teaching radical Marxism and communism. I swear I'm not making this up. I know you're not. So as teachers, what should we do in order to deal with this? I think you got to not be apologetic. Explain what you are teaching. Explain why you should teach it. And, engage in the argument. A lot of this red baiting is really not about Marxism or communism or whatever. It's about attacking the public education system. That's the right's real agenda. They want vouchers and charters and their friends to make money off public money for private education. And that's what their real objective is. So I think you just got to patiently explain to people why we need to teach things, including race relations and the history of race relations in this country. You know, some people want to avoid it. And, you know, the right says, oh, you're making white people feel bad. And, that's not what the teachers are doing. They're just trying to help people understand what has happened, how we got to where we are, and what we need to do to live up to our ideals of, you know, equality for everybody. So I think you just got to patiently explain and don't be apologetic or defensive. They're the ones that need to be defensive because they're talking like nuts. Scout Trooper 164. Would you ever conduct an interview with Breaking Points? That's a Crystal Ball, right? And her partner. I interviewed with them when they were Hill Rising, I think it was called, at the Hill. Yeah, I would. If they would have me. I have written to them recently. I pointed out to them that there's a story nobody's covering. And that is that this Freedom to Vote Act, the pared down version of the voting rights bill that they called originally, forgot the name. But anyway, what they did, yeah, Cristobal and Sagar and Jetty, what they did was eliminate public funding for presidential elections in the public campaign finance section of Freedom to Vote Act. Is basically exclusive of what Greens could do. You got to raise $50,000 in small contributions to get the matching funds for the House. And that's only a pilot program. It says very explicitly in that section of the bill that they will not use tax money to fund public campaign finance, which basically says they're going to keep relying on the $3 checkoff. They're going to take $300 million from the presidential campaign fund and I guess spend it till it runs out. They also set a limit on how much money can be spent in each state during the pilot program. It's $10 million. In a big state like California or New York, it's not going to be enough if you're serious about public funding. So there are a lot of problems with that. So anyway, I wrote to them and said, you know, would you like to cover this issue? I can talk about it. Haven't heard back. But I'm not sure I got the right person because since they moved, I'm not sure who their producers are. So maybe the communication didn't get there. But in any case, I'd love to go on Breaking Points and talk about that issue or a whole lot of others. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts on Georgia convicting people who were responsible for the murder of a black man? You're talking about the black man is Ahmed Arbery. And those three white guys chased him down a suburban street, cornered him, and shot him with a shotgun and killed him. Well, first of all, I don't think that case would have ever come forward if the geniuses who killed this man didn't release the video because they thought it would exonerate them. And the original district attorney who had the father, I'm forgetting their names, had worked for her. She just told him, you know, go home, wash your hands, and she did not want to prosecute. She is now facing charges for not, you know, malfeasance in office. And then she handed it over after that came to light to another prosecutor who recused himself. And finally, when the video went public, they couldn't avoid it. So those videos make a big difference. You know, George Floyd, would he have been convicted or would his killer, Derek Chauvin, have been convicted if that was not on video? These videos make a big difference. So you know, I thought it was pretty clear he should be convicted. The defense was pretty poor in this case in Georgia, and they kept, you know, trying to play the race card by talking about black ministers being in the court. And I mean, they just put the racial overtones into it. And I think, you know, the jury and the people of Brunswick didn't want to be known as this old fashioned Southern cracker town. So I wasn't that surprised about the conviction, although I recognized that if it hadn't been videotaped and that smart guy who was one of the convicted killers hadn't given it to the news, we never would have heard about this case. So, you know, when the evidence is clear, we can get convictions for people that deserve it. But if it's not, or relies on testimony and witnesses, it's a lot harder in these cases to get convictions for people that claim self-defense when they were the ones that instigated the whole incident. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts on electric bills rising during December? Well, utility bills tend to rise in December. Electric rates, that would depend on the fuels. I don't think coal has gone up. There's not much oil producing electricity. Gas has gone up. That's where, but you usually, yeah, well, gas, you charge gas for heating, and then gas-fired power plants are more expensive to run. But, you know, there are 50 states, and they're all regulated differently. So, like here in New York, they can't raise the electric rates till they get a new rate schedule. So, unless the gas price is built into the electric rate, and I don't know that. So, yeah, gas, look, renewables, if we built out a renewable infrastructure, we don't have to pay for fuel. So we don't get these rate shocks, because the sun shines, the wind blows, the waves and the waters flow, and those are your renewable sources of energy. So once you've made the capital investment in solar, wind, hydro, wave, and so forth, your fuel or your energy just flows right through your infrastructure and onto the grid. And most of the studies that look at what it's going to cost us to replace fossil fuels and nuclear fuels with renewables say that our electric rates are going to go down in the future because we don't have to pay for fuel all the time. Tom Bradburn, have you mentioned Jill's 2016? In reference to having to pay back, it's actually, it says 100,000. It's 175,000. I don't know if I mentioned it here, but I will. The FEC has said she has to pay back $175,000 they gave her because when she and her campaign submitted their matching funds documentation, FEC at first gave it to her. Now they're saying what they call the DOI, the date of ineligibility, was earlier than Jill Stein had claimed and what they had gone along with when they gave her the money. So now she's in a position of either having to pay that back, her campaign doesn't have the money, she's going to have to pay it out of her own pocket or out of donations from people like us, or she can appeal in court, which she's doing. She's appealing. Yeah, you know, I may not have this right. Anyway, I know she's getting ready to go to court, and she put out a fundraiser. You need money to pay the lawyers and the court fees. So she's going to challenge this in court. And what it has to do with is, what is the date of ineligibility? If you go back to early, what they call AOs, advisory opinions from the FEC, when the thing first got started in the 70s, they said that a third party, in this case, was the social workers, and it was actually Peter Cameo, who later became a Green, that when they petitioned to get on a ballot, that was their primary, so that they could collect funds and spend them on the primaries as long as they are petitioning. And the FEC hasn't been consistent over the years. So that's kind of what the suit revolves around. And she's got a good lawyer who has cut his teeth on ballot access, working for Nader in 2004 when the Democrats put everything in to keep Nader off the ballot. And so I think if you go to Jill's webpage, you'll find out more information. But that's what I know about the case. And if she wins it, then we're going to have be able to collect money from matching funds if they survive. I mentioned what's in the Freedom to Vote Act for a longer period that will enable us to finish our petitions and get on more state ballots when we run for president. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts of Haitians and Central Americans breaking through borders that Mexico set up as an agreement they made with the U.S. to keep them out? I believe in freedom of movement, and given the history of imperial oppression of Haiti and the Central American so-called republics, and now climate change, I think these people should be free to move to where opportunity is. We let capital move. We should let labor move, level the playing field. And, you know, Mexico was kind of forced into that by Trump, and now Biden's enforcing it. And to the extent Mexico is enforcing it, that would be at the Guatemalan border. Seems they enforce it sometimes and sometimes not. And that has a lot to do with corruption and the smugglers who make a lot of money off this, getting people from Guatemala to the U.S. border. But I think we need to move toward an open borders policy like they have in the EU, like those Central American republics have, like the Andean republics in South America have, like the East African Economic Union has, like India does with Bhutan and Nepal. This is common around the world. And in this country had no restrictions on immigration until the 20th century, when we basically closed off the borders to people that were not WASPs. You know, a lot of Italians and Eastern Europeans were coming to when we needed the labor, but in the 1920s, they really cut it off. And we have a whole history of excluding Chinese and Japanese. And Mexicans, we let them in when we need the labor and export them when we don't. A lot of the people that were exported, like during the 30s under Roosevelt, were actually U.S. citizens that lived here for generations, and they were just rounded up and shipped off to Mexico. I mean, all that is a terrible history that we're still practicing now. And so I think the border should be open. You should check in at the border, let people know who you are. If there's no warrant out for your arrest, you're free to go. And if you try to sneak past the border without checking in, it's probably due because you do have a warrant, and we should probably, grab those people. But right now, I mean, with the Haitians, we're shipping them back to deadly situations. That country is in chaos. It doesn't really have a government. You have gangs running the streets, and the poverty is just, it kills you. So I think we need to move toward open borders. And the first thing toward that is to provide documentation for the undocumented in this country so they can live their life above ground. They can access services. If they're a witness to a crime, they can actually, testify rather than be afraid of getting caught up in immigration and sent out of the country. That really creates a problem for solving crimes. So there's a lot of good reasons to, open up the border and welcome immigrants. And, we complain about a labor shortage and there are people wanting to come here to work. I mean, that's a simple solution right there. Eric Gray, what are your thoughts on Chris Hedges and his goal of creating more teachers from our prison system? I know Chris is teaching in the prison system. I didn't know he was encouraging, the way it's written here, prisoners to become teachers. But I think, you know, if otherwise they meet the criteria and they've served their time, paid their dues, there could be good teachers coming out of the prison system. They've had the School of Hard Knocks as well as the formal credentials teachers have to get to teach in the public school. So I think, you know, and going from a situation where you ended up in prison, assuming you're guilty, to where you can become a teacher is definitely what we would call rehabilitation. And that should be a goal of the prison system. So so anyway, I all I know is Chris has been teaching in the prisons, and it's he has a lot to say about how we treat our prisoners. We don't treat them well. Scout Trooper 164, would you cover that the U.S. is still in war in seven countries? Iraq, Yemen, Syria, shadow war in Africa, Iran, etc. Yeah, well, in most cases, what we're doing is trying to make the world safe for U.S.-based global corporations, safe to exploit labor, extract resources, or set up production, you know, factories with weak environmental and labor regulations. That's really why we're at war in most cases. I think there are exceptions. I think the war against ISIS was not about that. It was about ISIS, which is a death cult and a danger to the people of Syria and Iraq and other countries. But the shadow war in Africa, I guess shadow, you mean it's not very open. But we are definitely involved in counterinsurgency, and we portray it as fighting ISIS or Al-Qaeda. But if you look at it country by country, and I rely on people that study Africa, I've known like William Minter since the anti-apartheid movement in the 80s. And he says, you know, these are insurgencies against corruption and, you know, inequality enforced by elites in those countries. So it's not just some kind of Islamic fundamentalist jihad. It's really people fighting back against an oppressive system. And they're Muslims, and the jihadis, you know, are there ready to fight. So they may gravitate to their organizations without believing that whole ideology. So, you know, we get involved in these counterinsurgency, which just produces more people want to fight back, because we use drones and kill, you know, innocent people in places like Somalia and Afghanistan and Syria. We just had an expose in the New York Times, and that was in the war against ISIS, but it documents a case where we killed, I think it was like 90, basically women and children in Raqqa, which was the last urban holdout of ISIS. So that was probably not intentional to get civilians, at least in part of on the part of U.S. policy. But when you fight those wars with drones and remote, you know, shooting, drone fire, drone rockets, that happens. And then, you know, people get mad and they want to fight back. So it's counterproductive for peace and U.S. security. So, you know, I think we're better off in a lot of these places providing COVID vaccines, climate reparations to help people deal with the changes that have happened to their environments due to climate change, and help them build renewable energy infrastructure so they can be powered. And a lot of these countries, you know, have a problem with power as it is. So this is a way for them to leap out of the, you know, 1800s fossil fuel era into the 21st century solar era. So there's a lot of alternatives to having 800 foreign military bases. And, you know, it depends on how you count, but you can count up to 13 countries. Well, that was with Afghanistan. Call it 12 countries where we're engaged. We have combat troops on the ground, usually in small numbers. We don't have, you know, the big invasions like we did of Iraq. But what we do is have special forces, advisors, and then they use local troops to do the fighting, which is what we did in the war against ISIS with the Syrian Democratic Force, which is Kurds and Assyrians and Arabs. It's mostly Kurds, but they came together to fight ISIS. And it's what we've done in other places, you know, like being advisors to the Afghan army, which was not very successful, let's put it that way, because we ended up attacking, you know, doing these home raids, looking for terrorists, which just made everybody angry, bombing the wrong people, getting caught in intra and intertribal feuds where we ended up aligned with one side without understanding that we were being played. Anand Gopal has a book about Afghanistan. It's about, I don't know, 8 or 10 years old now. He embedded with the Taliban to find out what the other side was experiencing. And it's quite eye-opening in terms of how the Afghanis were basically playing the U.S. military to get their money and also get revenge against their rivals within Afghan society. So, yeah, the military is a blunt instrument and rarely the right solution. So I think we should find a way to get out of these wars and become the world's humanitarian superpower, make friends instead of enemies, and provide aid instead of arms. Steve Talbot, when electric cars take over, more energy will be sent to homes and stations to charge these cars. To meet these demands, the grid will need to be upgraded. How do we get the political will to do this? Well, I think, you know, the Green Party needs to keep pushing the Green New Deal because the Democrats walked away from it after diluting it in those non-binding Green New Deal resolutions, which have never been voted on. And one thing I'm concerned about, and I'm about to go look at this in detail, is that the Build Back Better and infrastructure bills don't have much for grid upgrades. And basically the upgrades got to be, we got to move from a servo mechanical grid where you have central power plants and they send the electricity out to consumers, to an interactive digital grid, a smart grid, which balances supply and demand, including timing when electricity is consumed in homes and businesses so that you maximize the efficiency. And when demand is down, you get a lower price. And then homes and businesses can be energy producers with rooftop solar or wind on their property, and they should be able to put that on the grid and get paid for it with net metering. All that requires a whole new kind of grid. Excuse me. Plus, we're going to need high volume transmission lines to get from the big wind and solar production offshore in the plains for the wind, in the southwest for the solar, to where it's needed. So there's a lot to do there. And I've seen enormous numbers, and I don't have them in my head right now, for investment to do this grid upgrade. And I don't see it in either the infrastructure bill or the Build Back Better bill. So it's something to get the political will, we got to do some education and then push political leaders and run our own people as Greens who want to do this. Eldred Jonas, hello, I'm from California. Extremely expensive. Yeah, I know. I'm originally from California. I can't afford to live there anymore. Want to continue my education, but with college, university, increasing cost yearly, I'm discouraged. Why are prices going higher every year in education? Well, part of it is there's a lot of bureaucracy building by the university. So they're providing a lot more expensive housing and student centers and athletic facilities. You know, they just weren't there when I was coming up. It was basically tuition free at state colleges and universities. There was some student fees and you had to buy your textbooks. So that was about it. And you had to, you know, buy your lodging. But the tuition was free. Now they keep raising tuition to fund not only this physical infrastructure, but the high salaries. And they're seems to be more administrators every year. So we got to get control of that. That's part of why prices are rising. And the other part is the public is, you know, the government is not investing in public education or even the grants they give to private universities and colleges. So that's the other reason. So they got to make that up with tuition. So again, it's a political problem. We got to get our priorities straight. Scout Trooper 164, what is your message to progressives who view you negatively? Well, why do they view me negatively? Because I'm quote unquote spoiling it for the Democrats? Look, if you're a progressive, if you don't vote for what you want, you get lost in the sauce. If you want single payer health care, a Green New Deal, cancellation of student debt, you vote for the Democrats, you're voting against that. You know, Biden was against all those things. Yeah, on the left fringe of the Democratic Party, there's some people that do support Medicare for All and the Green New Deal, but not most of them. So my message to progressives is, you know, if you're a progressive, vote for what you want. And if you view the Greens negatively because we might split the vote, why don't you get angry at the Democrats who don't even agree with you for splitting the vote? You know, what we ought to unite on is getting proportional representation and ranked choice voting, so people can vote for what they want without worrying about splitting the center and left so the right gets in. Scout Trooper 164, what do you think about Julian Assange's father making about a movie about his struggle to save his son? Well, I think that's part of the struggle to save his son. I was not aware he's doing that, but I hope it goes well and it gets out soon. You know, the Julian Assange case is really a freedom of the press case. And Assange published leaked information. And we see that every day in the New York Times and the Washington Post. We find out most of what we know about the government from leaks, not from open sources or people willing to go on the record. So, you know, if they are able to convict Julian Assange, that puts a chill on every investigative reporter in any journal. And the fact that he's an Australian, not even an American, makes it even worse, because that means reporters around the world will be think twice about bringing to light public information, bringing to the public information that's been provided them on the QT from the government by whistleblowers. It's such an important case in that regard. So, you know, I wish Julian Assange's father well in making that movie. Michael Shin, thoughts on social alternative building ties with the DSA? Should the Green Party do the same? I'm not deeply involved in this. From what I've heard, social alternative was on the left of DSA and was pushing for DSA to take a more independent political stance. And at their last convention, they actually made their commitments more to the Democratic Party. Some of their leading thinkers were calling for a dirty break with the Democratic Party. In other words, as the left wing of the Democratic Party gets stronger, there will be conflict between the corporate center and the socialist left. And at some point, it'll lead to a split. I've been skeptical of that, because even the Democratic Socialists that DSA is supporting in for state legislature and Congress and city councils, none of them run on a program of a dirty break with the Democratic Party. I think the logic of what they're doing is to burrow them, to tie them deeper into the Democratic Party. Now, DSA does other stuff beside electoral politics, labor support, issue campaigns, and that's where I think the Greens should really work with them. And when we do run, you know, go to them and ask for their endorsement. I got the endorsement of 3 DSA locals, not big ones, sort of in the middle of the country. They caught hell from the New York leadership, but more power to them for making up their own mind. We have had DSA, like we ran candidates in Pittsburgh, or a candidate in Pittsburgh, Connor Mulvaney, which DSA supported, did phone banking for him. So I, you know, we should work with them. I don't think we should. What Social Alternative did was encourage their members to become members of DSA. And, you know, that may be a good move for some Greens in some cities. I'm not doing it here in Syracuse, because I think most of the DSA people here have been Democrats all along. They were the Sanders people and just liberal Democrats. And they're, you know, they're very much committed to the Democratic Party. So it doesn't make much sense for me, but it may in some cities. Scout Trooper 164, what alliances can the Green Party make to help it rise to dominance in new heights? Well, we should work with everybody willing to work with us. I think the main thing we need to do is build up our locals and recruit people that are not the usual suspects who, you know, find progressive politics on their own or the Green Party on their own. We need to be out there. I call it deep canvassing, or they call it deep canvassing. Go out and knock on doors, talk to people. You know, you don't preach, you listen. Hear what's on people's minds. Then maybe you can relate it to what the Green platform might have that's relevant to their concerns. But build relationships and invite them to activities and, you know, be sure that they see you active on the issues. So they begin to realize they can trust you and that you're not here today, gone tomorrow. You just come out at election time and be more grassroots than the Democrats and Republicans and have those personal relationships that will enable people to trust us. And that includes the people that, especially, that vote in low numbers, working class people, people of color, and young people. We got to give them a reason to trust us. I think that starts with just talking to them. So rather than alliances with existing organizations, we need to do what nobody's really doing, and that is mass organizing at the grassroots level. You know, there's an old slogan, you know, we shouldn't be organizing the left. We should be organizing the people. Because even if the left all got together, it would be a very small portion of society. So I'm more for grassroots organizing and building relationships at the grassroots and building mass-based local parties. Well, I guess that's the last question I'm going to get because it's been almost an hour. And haven't had time to keep up with the chat. I'll look at that afterwards. But somebody says, am I running in 2024? I'll answer that one. I don't know. I think we got to get through 2022 here in New York. We got to get our ballot line back. That's a monster task. So I'm not even going to think about that and look at that until we get through these midterms. And then meanwhile, I guess I'll just close by saying, you know, the Democrats are failing even by their own standards. You know, the it's called the Freedom to Vote Act now, HR1, it was originally, I'm forgetting the title, I don't know why I can't remember that, but, you know, that was HR1 for a reason. They were going to do a lot of electoral reforms. They can't even get that passed. Build Back Better, the climate program, the social programs within Build Back Better have been cut, watered down. Where they do have social programs, they've tended toward the neoliberal model of privatization. So instead of, for example, providing childcare through the public schools, like they are planning to do with pre-K for 4 and 5 year olds, they're going to, you know, farm it out to private insurance or private childcare companies. Same thing with if they do the paid leave rather than a public program, it's going to be like our healthcare system where you got to buy the insurance and they'll mandate that the employers and employees pay the or set up the programs. So there's just a lot of problems with what they're doing. And the biggest thing that they're not doing is fighting back against this Republican assault on our democracy. And, you know, that's why we need the Greens. The Democrats don't know how to fight the fascists. They Biden still wants to do bipartisanship with a party that tried to overthrow his election. It's just unbelievable. And what's the recent example? Oh, you know, the new, he reappointed Powell to be the head of the Fed, and he called it a bipartisan gesture with a party that didn't even recognize that he won the election. So that's just to say we need to get out there, build our locals, talk to the people, run candidates, be active on the issues, and come out swinging, because right now, you know, nobody else is going to save us. The Democrats, certainly not the Republicans. So, you know, just put yourself, pace yourself. I mean, sometimes people jump in with both feet and sprint till they're exhausted and say that didn't work and they give up. It's more a marathon. So you got to pace yourself and be active in a steady way. And if you don't have a local, you're not in an organization, that's the first thing. As another old saying is, there's no such thing as an unorganized socialist. When we're in groups, we get smarter because we got to test our ideas, talk them through, and everybody brings something to the table and we all get better. So that's just my recommendation for what we need to be doing. So we'll be here next Saturday, and thanks for being here this Saturday. Love.